Welcome to session 4 of the PDH online course on the 2008 National Electric Code. We're going to start now on Article 200, Use and Identification of Grounded Conductors. The basic idea here is that there are one or more hot conductors which carry electricity from the source to the load. There is often a neutral or grounded power conductor which carries unbalanced current back to the source. There is one or more of these grounds, which there are one or more additional grounds which keep the voltage down for personnel safety and provide a safe return path for fault current. Now let me say that again. There's a lot of content in there, and the words sound so ordinary, but the ideas are not exactly ordinary. We're talking about basically three conductors: a hot that carries electricity to the load, a neutral that returns current back from the load to the source so that we have a complete circuit, and a safety ground which carries no current except in the event of a ground fault. Now, it gets confusing because in a three-phase circuit, we'll have a balanced three-phase circuit, we'll have three hots taking it out, no neutral, no even attempt for a neutral, but the safety ground. Well, that's a special case. It's a very common special case, and it's a very wonderful case. Saves us an awful lot of money in industrial distribution, but that's a special case. Similarly, in a 12240 circuit, typically we think of that as two hots with a neutral to carry back any unbalance. But a lot of HVAC equipment will not permit you to have any imbalance. They are all 220 volt devices. They're only connected from hot to hot. So you have two hots, no neutral, but yes, the safety ground conductor. And it's the safety ground conductor that typically causes the most problem. The neutral is not required for 480 volt power to motors and most large equipment. By the magic of balanced three-phase circuitry, all three current flows sum to zero. If they don't sum to zero, the system adjusts internally, and they do sum to zero. And if you look at it, there's nothing else to do with them. So they sum to zero, and you get some funny imbalances and all kinds of strange things. But let's just assume they do sum to zero, because I've done measurements on this, and they do sum to zero. And I say this very seriously. I tried to unbalance the voltage to see what would happen, and I could never see what happened because the motor overloads tripped out before I could measure the voltage imbalance. So when I hear people say, we've got a voltage imbalance here, it is a minute voltage imbalance. It's so rare that the utility will give you an unbalance, or you'll actually get winding errors in your transformer that make any difference. And the motors trip off immediately. They don't like voltage imbalance. The neutral or grounded conductor is not a problem in these circuits. In 121, that's 120 single phase circuits, and most 12240 circuits, and most 208-120 circuits, a neutral is required, however. The 120 volt circuit is only supply and return with the neutral. The 12240 may be a 240 supply hot and a 240 return also hot, but usually there's a neutral present to handle a small fan or timer in the equipment from one hot to the neutral. Real 208 volt equipment like rooftop HVAC units may be power only with no neutral, but it's important to check. 208 and 208/120 are not the same, and it costs money to add the neutral later. Most 208-120 circuits are not balanced and will have a neutral current approaching or exceeding the hot conductor current. Switching power supplies like wall warts on electronics pull heavy short duration pulses of current that do not balance on three phase or 12240 volt circuits. You must recognize the current flow in the neutral circuit. Safety precautions in design and installation are necessary to avoid the same shocks an electrician can get from a hot conductor. Now, let me say this again. Everybody thinks it's a grounded conductor. You can't get shocked from a grounded conductor. Sure enough, you leave that intact and it stays very close to ground. I've actually measured things a volt or two above ground, but so close to ground that it looks like ground. But the minute you loosen the screw and open it, you've placed the supply voltage across that open circuit. It's a white wire going into a white screw, but there's line voltage across it, line to neutral voltage. If you open the neutral flow on an energized circuit, the line to neutral voltage appears on that break and an arc. I mean, that's what happens when you open an energized circuit. It arcs. For this reason, neutrals require the same insulation as hot conductors and as much care in labeling as hot conductors. And we're going to get into that when we get into the multi-wire circuits, because the danger on this. Well, there's a danger on the hot and there's a danger on the neutral, and the goal is to recognize it. As mentioned previously, the code requires that a facility containing 120 and 480 circuits use distinctive color systems for both. An example given in the National Electric Code Handbook is as follows. This is me trying to read an illustration to you. We've got two big columns here, which are 120-208 and 277-480. We've got phase A, B, C, and neutral for both the 120-208 and for the 277-480. For 120-208, A, B, C, neutral reads black, red, blue, white. For 277-480, phase A, B, C, neutral reads brown, orange, yellow, gray. Now catch that gray as opposed to white. And this is what I was just talking about. A current-carrying neutral conductor is dangerous when you're working on, when you're doing maintenance. Guys do maintenance, and they do maintenance on neutrals. If you can distinguish the 480-volt neutral conductor from the 120-volt neutral conductor, at least you have a better chance to know what you're working on and avoid a surprise because you're on a foreign system that you didn't even realize. The text in the National Electric Code Handbook, non-enforceable, states that the use of gray for 277-480 is not required, but common. The wording of the code permits phase conductors with longitudinal white stripes or lateral white stripes at terminations for either neutral. They must be different colors when there's a likelihood of both appearing in the same equipment or cabinet. Now we'll talk about branch circuits in Article 210. The article contains requirements for branch circuits, as you might expect. However, it also contains requirements for residential ground fault circuit interrupters and arc flash circuit interrupters. Now this course has specifically excluded residential installations, but we're going to talk about GFCI and AFCI because they're new and not obvious. Back to branch circuits, however, the definition of a multi-wire branch circuit is developing as we speak. It clearly applies to residential, where 120-240 and a single neutral go to a switch box for a switched receptacle and a switched overhead light. Similarly, it applies to commercial and institutional, where 120-208 and a single neutral loop around supplying a number of receptacles on three separate circuits. It appears to apply to 277-480 with a single neutral serving a lot of ceiling fluorescence with individual switch legs. There are two special requirements in Article 210. First, the conductors making up the multi-wire circuits must be grouped, that is, physically tied, when they pass through a junction box or at the originating panel. Second, all the hots must be opened by a single circuit disconnect. The second requirement makes sense and is easy at the panel, a three-pole breaker. It makes sense in the overhead space near fluorescence, but it's not easy unless all of the lights are on a common switch leg. More conventionally, up to 63 fixtures, that's 16 amps times 277 volts divided by 70 volt amps per fixture, that's for 63 fixtures, can be switched on one phase with a one pole switch. When the switch is off, there are return currents flowing from the other phases through the neutral. By disconnecting all three phases simultaneously, there cannot be a return current flowing. But obviously, similarly, the wall switch is not adequate disconnect before doing maintenance. Regarding ground fault circuit interrupters, residential occupancies are required to have personnel, GFCIs. Those are the 5 milliamp trip units. The just replacement circuit breaker goes in the panel, or the GFCI receptacle. A lot of times they use in bathrooms. This must have GFCIs on circuits in bathrooms, garages, outdoors, crawl spaces, unfinished basements, kitchens, at laundry, utility, wet bar sinks, and at boathouses. There are a range of details, but note that the exceptions are being deleted one by one. The goal of the code is to maximize safety. The 2008 code removes the exception for dedicated receptacles for appliances in inaccessible location. The reasoning was that it's better to lose a freezer full of meat than take a chance on a shock. Now, if you find that just a little bit inflammatory, it is paraphrased from the 2008 National Electric Code Seminar hosted by the National Association of Electrical Inspectors. Non-residential occupancies are required to have GFCIs in bathrooms, kitchens, rooftops, outdoors, at sinks, and at boathouses. There are fine points regarding each location, but note that the trend is to provide a GFCI for general purpose receptacles. Industrial 120-volt shop and assembly line hand tools are not presently covered, and outdoor receptacles for recharging autos and engine block heaters are not presently covered. Personnel ground fault protection, the same GFCI but often cord-mounted, is required for construction hand tools. Regarding arc flash circuit interrupters, arc flash circuit interrupters are required on all outlets in family rooms, dining rooms, living rooms, parlors, libraries, dens, bedrooms, sunrooms, recreation rooms, closets, hallways, and other similar areas. Arc flash circuit interrupter is not required for basements, garages, or fire alarm wiring in conduit. And this is the reason why the 2008 code is slow to be adopted by many states, because the building contractors are saying this is going to add a minimum of $1,000 to a home price. And do we really want to do that in this economy? Article 215 is about feeders. Protection for feeder circuits must be sized at 125% the continuous load plus 100% of the non-continuous load. This always works. There's an expensive option for large loads by using 100% rated protective devices. The 100% rated devices are available only in electronic trip units, considerably more expensive than simple thermomagnetic trips. On the other hand, circuits above 1,000 amps on 277-480 require ground fault protection, which is another feature only available on electronic trips. There are additional rules to permit adding load, including non-continuous load derating for some machine tools and often misused for general purpose loads, and a demand factor to reflect loads not operating at rated nameplate. I have used these special calculations when the calculated load is about 1% above a standard circuit breaker frame size, requiring a step increase in enclosure size. Beyond that, it's contrary to the code's intent, because the code's intent is that the designer provide capacity for future growth. And sizing things exactly precisely on the rating, that doesn't leave anything for future. The 125% requirement is usually referred to as the 80% rule, since a circuit breaker can only be loaded up to 80% of its rating under normal circumstances. And again, the exception is the 100% rated device. The article in the code suggests a diagram of feeders showing sources, loads, square feet of the facility served by each, and any derating factors used. The diagram is discretionary to the authority having jurisdiction. Now, one of my supervisors assigned his staff to make diagrams for all of our plants during a time of light workload, and it was very interesting how areas of service overlap after years of maintenance. The diagram was very valuable to newly hired maintenance electricians. The requirement for identified conductor colors for each voltage level in the facility is restated here, along with the recommendation of distinguished neutrals. As previously stated, the NEC handbook provides the following example. For 120-208, phase A, B, C, and neutral, black, red, blue, and white. for 277, 480, phase A, B, C in neutral, brown, orange, yellow, and gray. Peculiar observation. I was doing observation of construction on a massive data expansion. The data racks were in and the panels, but no equipment and only three cables of data wiring. I was examining the ground bus, a 1/4 by 3 by 12 inch bar, with building ground, panel ground, and tapped holes for data grounds. There was only one data ground connected. It went to the overhead steel ladder tray. I was interested to see how they bonded connected sections of the data tray, since we go to a lot of trouble with bonding conductors on power trays. But there was no bonding between the sections. I found some more green conductors, apparently identical to the number 6 AWG for the ground tray. They were data cables. All of the Cat 6 data cabling on the project had a green jacket and is the diameter of number 6 AWG insulated ground. And I did follow up with them, and they said that's the way they do it. They use the tray as their grounding means. And they have this big empty terminal with all the tapped holes on it. Ooh, my. Article 230 is about services. Article presents new labeling for surge protection devices and explains the application better than previous editions of the code. As discussed previously, surge protection devices must be labeled type 1, type 2, type 3, or type 4. Older units without this labeling are non-compliant. Type 1 is for line side of the service entrance. Type 2 is for load side of the service entrance, or at panels. Type 3 and 4 are at the load. The line side connection is not new, but clearly presented now. The advantage is that because SPD, surge protective device operation, is cumulative. Each additional SPD device reduces the remaining surge that is carried on to other connections from the same source. Keeping the SPD online when you take down the service means that protection for other services remains intact. The code is moving into proper connection of parallel power production systems. That's usually photovoltaics or cogeneration or wind farms or actually fuel cells. People are starting to put in fuel cells. As photovoltaic, fuel cell, wind and water generating systems are becoming more common, the NEC is including standards for proper connection and protection. This is non-trivial, since electric utilities have invested 100 years in learning how to connect power sources in new systems. The utilities have spent 100 years learning how to do it, but new systems are being stalled by quick profit vendors. The greatest experience with parallel power production is in second home cabins in the West. Rich folk need their satellite TV when they are roughing it. A moderate-sized photovoltaic array and some deep discharge wet cells provide the necessary amenities, but they will not support air conditioning or electric water heating. Parallel power production means that both the utility and local sources are available, and air conditioning and electric hot water heating can be provided. This is introduced by the briefest reference in the article. The majority of the content of the article regards service conductors, service switches, and service protection. The controlling requirements for service conductors and service switchers, however, are the local utility regulations, usually clearly stated in a brochure. The utility may be more stringent than the National Electric Code and may have peculiarities. If you want them to energize the service, you do it their way. It's very desirable to have a utility representative review the installation before requesting that it be energized. This article introduces the requirement for equipment ground fault protection for 277 480 volt systems of 1000 amps or more. A later section adds complexity to the situation, however. Emergency systems and critical operation power systems must be coordinated. That is, a low-level downstream fault must not cause a high-level protective device to operate, unnecessarily isolating the emergency or critical operation power system. If you put a ground fault protection sensor on a service, you have to do something to make sure it does not unnecessarily knock off important loads at the bottom. This is not hard to do, but it's expensive, a little complicated, and requires maintenance. There are three obvious solutions. Coordinated ground fault protection, delaying the high level until the low level has had a chance to clear. upstream inhibit, block the upstream protection while the downstream is taking care of the problem, and provide a separate service for important loads. The advantage of the third choice is that it's similar to normal installation of a fire pump, and installing contractors are familiar with this, and it's brute force simple. There's nothing confusing about a separate service for emergency and critical operations services. Overcurrent protection is discussed in Article 240. It is the characteristic of electric wires, transformers, and most equipment that a small overload can be tolerated for a long time. A large overload can be tolerated for a very short time. This relationship is called an inverse time overcurrent curve. So when we speak of overcurrent protection, we do not mean measure and disconnect above a set point. Rather, we mean follow the pattern, and when the resulting time overcurrent function exceeds the time overcurrent protection curve, then disconnect. This revision of the code adds current limits or ampacities for small conductors with some interpretations. 18 American wire gauge gets 5.6 amps. 16 American wire gauge gets 8 amps. And by the way, I'm very careful the way I'm quoting this. And you can get a little more current out of these if you meet some special characteristics. I like carrying forward these ideas because to me an 18 gauge looks like 5.6 amps and a 16 gauge looks like 8 amps. Protection must be provided by circuit breakers or fuses listed for protection of these wires or by current limiting fuses. The change is important in accompanying the NEC taking regulatory control over industrial control panels, which typically have used the smaller conductors for internal wiring in some remote devices. 14 AWG is 15 amps, 12 AWG is 20 amps, and 10 AWG is 30 amps. These are not changed. They're not exactly conductor ratings, but NEC limits for conductor use. The values of 14 through 10 are not new, but were hidden previously in notes on the ampacity tables. Tap conductors are regulated by this article. Tap conductors are almost magic. I remember when I first encountered this. You mean you don't need a fuse disconnect or circuit breaker? Well, truthfully, you do need a fuse disconnect or circuit breaker, but you don't have to put it exactly at the tap. You can put it a short distance away, and that's what this section states, how far away you can put the protective device. And this makes all the sense in the world when you think of the feeders running overhead and you want the disconnect where someone can operate it manually. Tap conductors are regulated by this article. The idea that the feeder goes from the source to the load with protection of the feeder conductor at the source. It's very often desirable to tap into the feeder at some midpoint to supply another load. The cleanest and easiest way to do this is by tapping with the same size as the feeder. This is a full capacity taps and requires no limitation since the source protection is exactly right for the tap. Much more common, however, to have a really large feeder and only need a small amount of current for the intermediate load. Special cases have been set up to permit this. Please consider a circuit breaker or fuse disconnect being installed for the intermediate load. If it's a small load, then it will be a small protective device with small incoming wires. The tap conductor from the feeder to the protective device is limited by one of the following rules. The 10-foot one-tenth rule, the 25-foot one-third rule, or the 100-foot industrial drop one-third rule, or the outdoor unlimited rule. In general, you can run a tap 10 feet if it has one-tenth the rating of the feeder. You can run a tap 25 feet if it's one-third the rating of the feeder. You can run a tap 100 feet as an industrial drop if it has one-third of the rating of the feeder. And you can run a tap on an outdoor feeder for an unlimited length with some restrictions on how it enters the building. And this is back to the idea if there is a burn down outside, it's a burn down onto the grass or onto concrete or maybe onto asphalt. It's not a burn down onto flammable Xerox paper. Another restriction is that you cannot tap a tap. That is, you tap after the protective device and it's a new circuit, but you cannot tap between the feeder and the protective device. The article requires that overcurrent devices be readily accessible. Now, again, that we talked about this, probably the first topic, the difference between accessible and readily accessible. No ladder required. The handle cannot be more than 6.5 feet above the floor. And there are exceptions for this. The one that comes to mind is for overhead bus duct. Overhead bus duct is just a fantastic way to supply power. And there are special rules to encourage its use. It's a very safe, very reliable method. And expensive, but then everything's expensive. Also, if the equipment's mounted overhead, that's where you want the disconnect to. Remember, from definition sections, readily accessible means a ladder is not required. However, protective devices above drop ceilings are specifically permitted and disconnects at very awkward locations but adjacent to the device being protected. Some screwy things come up in odd electrical distribution systems. You are always safe if the rating of the protective device matches the rating of the system. For instance, three-phase Delta is still in use. As they're not normally grounded, protective devices must be rated for line-to-line voltage. A circuit breaker is rated 480 volts. It is not rated 277-480 because 277 is the voltage from line to ground. And during a single line fault, which happens on Delta systems, you're going to apply 480 across there. So it must be a 480 breaker on a 480 system. 277 only if it's a 277-480 system. Slash voltage rating is critical. High leg Delta systems are still in service. Now, if you're not familiar with this, you're lucky. The high leg has a higher line-to-ground voltage than the line-to-line rating. Special high leg Delta circuit breakers are required. This is an old system that appeared economical at the time, but people don't think it's economical anymore. What you did was you put in a 120-240 volt installation, just absolutely conventional 120-240 volt. Then, in theory, you put in a lower rated third leg so that you had a little bit of Delta. And the strange thing about this was they had special transformers for doing this. It was called a tickler transformer that just produced this funny high leg. And if you ever run into these systems, they are peculiar animals. And they're being replaced by typically 480 with a 120-208, 120-240 step-down transformers. The article discusses series rated protective devices. We discussed this previously. Normally, when you have a panel fed by conductors that deliver 25,000 amps, you'd buy a 42,000 amp disconnect. It's legal per the series combination rule to use a 42,000 amp main and 10,000 amp branch circuits if and only if the main will open before the branch breakers. I mean, they have to be special breakers, or they have to be tested to satisfy this requirement. That's so that when there is a heavy overload, the main takes it instead of the branches. That is, the branches never see the 42,000 amp arc. It's legal and much cheaper. The section and earlier section say that a box must be labeled to make sure that only identical breakers are used for maintenance and replacement. The underlying question is whether the designer is willing to trust the label to ensure safe maintenance in the future. If not, do not use the series combination system. If so, make sure the labels are applied. The article applies to ground fault protection for 1,000 amp services to feeders of 1,000 amps or larger. The wording is different. The ground fault protection if the total service is 1,000 amp, not just an individual service switch. Now, let's say that again. If you're using the six switch rule and your six switches total more than 1,000 amps, then you're requiring ground fault protection, even though there is no 1,000 amp switch in present. Let's come back to Article 250, grounding and bonding, after a break. This is certainly an important topic and deserves a fresh approach. So come back and join me in a few minutes or tomorrow if that meets your schedule better.